Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the 505th episode of the Hollywood Reporter's Awards Chatter podcast. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and my guest today is a stand-up comedian, actor, and author who has been a fan favorite for decades. Perhaps best known as one of the four stand-ups featured in Spike Lee's blockbuster documentary The Original Kings of Comedy back in 2000, he also starred on TV programs such as the WB's The Steve Harvey Show from 1996 through 2002, and on CBS's The Neighborhood, which began in 2018 and is heading into its sixth season. And he's also been in numerous films, most notably the Barbershop Trilogy, with installments in 2002, 2004, and 2016. Back in 2002, A.O. Scott wrote in the New York Times, quote, "He takes his obligations to the audience seriously, and no comedian working today holds up his end of the bargain better," close quote. He, of course, is Cedric Kiles, better known as Cedric the Entertainer. Over the course of our conversation at the LA offices of The Hollywood Reporter, the 59-year-old and I discussed his unexpected path to comedy and the origin of his unusual stage name, his occasional forays into dramatic acting in films such as 2007's Talk to Me, 2008's Cadillac Records, and 2017's First Reformed, his debut novel, Flipping Boxcars, co-written with Alan Eisenstock, which was inspired by a grandfather he never met, and which Amistad, a division of HarperCollins, will release on September 12th, plus much more. And so, without further ado, let's go to that conversation. Cedric, thank you so much for coming and doing this. Great to have you. And to begin with, can we just share with our listeners, where were you born and raised, and what did your folks do for a living?
I was born in Jefferson City, Missouri. That's the capital of Missouri, the state capital. And my mother was a school teacher for over 30 years, elementary school educator, a reading specialist. And then my father worked for the version of AT&T. So okay. It was Western something electric for a while. Then that company kept growing too. Yeah. Eventually it was AT&T, same company for many years.
Any siblings?
Yeah, retired. I have a younger sister who is a professor at Pepperdine University. Oh, wow. She teaches public speaking.
Cool. Yeah. So I read that you were interested in performing from an early age to the extent that maybe there was a school sort of like Fame where you were.
Yeah.
You wanted to go there. It didn't happen, right?
No, it was too far from my home. You know, we had moved to the suburban area of St. Louis. I would have had to take a bunch of city buses to go to this school. And my mom just, you know, again, being a single parent, you know, at raising us, she just couldn't really handle me, like, literally ride probably 30 miles to school.
Jeez. Yeah. So where you did go to school, and I think you moved, I read you moved a bit as a kid, were you known as a funny kid?
Yeah, definitely. I was, you know, I definitely kind of grew into that. It was funny because my mother was a school teacher in the district. So I was not the class clown.
But you would have heard of
that. Yeah, exactly. They would have been like, I know your mother. Yeah. But I was very witty, definitely was known for having a sense of humor. And, you know, of course, I was the guy that they, you know, my friends would, you know, if they got to doing the dozens or, you know, doing the, you know, what they call bagging on people at lunch, then, you know, my friends, wait to see it come. You don't want it when see it come. You
know? So eventually you head off to Southeast Missouri State University, and I see you majored in communications. At that time of your life, not that you had to know, but what did you think you might want to do with your life at that point?
I really thought I was going to be a lawyer.
Really?
You know, it was interesting. Like, again, I performed in plays and in singing groups in high school. Never really, you know, once my mother, you know, made, you know, kind of like made me really focus on the trajectory of going to college, I, you know, then my best kind of attribute was being argumentative, like a person that could, and debate, mm-hmm. if you will, more so than argumentative, I would say. I was good at debate, making a point, being able to kind of be in these circles where I can, like, you know, counter any argument. So I was like, oh, and I loved law shows. Like, that was my thing. Like, from Madlock to Perry Mason to L.A. Law, like, all those shows that was me. So I was like, this is what I would do.
Instead, you graduate, and what was the first job after school?
So, you know, the first job after I graduated was it was interesting because I actually had gotten a job being at a CBS affiliate as a news reporter, never got to go to work. The job got canceled before I actually ever went into work.
You would have been an on-air news
guy? I would have been a reporter. And this was in the early days of the fun news when shows like Entertainment Tonight were making a stride and coming on. And so each local station was hiring a guy to go do a fun story. And they hired me to do this. I always say this, Dan Rather got hired to be the nightly yeah, anchor, yeah. And they paid him $18 million a year.
They took
that salary right from every affiliate along the way. So I never actually got a chance to go to work. But so then I come home and I start working at Best Buy. Mm-hmm. And eventually I had a paper route. I threw the Wall Street Journal. Mm-hmm. And then finally I sold fax machines for Rico Corporation, and then finally landed at State Farm as a claims adjuster.
Okay, so the fact that CBS was interested in you for the funny segments, had you auditioned? How did they know that you were even a funny guy?
Yeah, you know, of course I'd studied communications, and I had a TV show that I did in college. I did some local commercials for another station, not the CBS affiliate, but the even more local station there, I guess, like the Channel 11 or 9 or whatever of Cape Girardeau, Missouri. But I did some commercials for them, so I had a cool little reel, and I had a radio show when I was in college. So I kind of gave them all these things, and they saw my personality and was like, all right, let's do it.
So, meanwhile, that gets dashed, that dream gets dashed, and you're at State Farm selling, as you say, or doing claims adjusting.
Yeah.
Was somebody else that worked there thought you were funny, or was a comedian, or what was going on?
No, you know, it was, at the time, I had a great friend. We were roommates. We had a house together, and he had a friend that was a stand-up. And his friend was, you know, out working as a stand-up, and he would go like, man, that's funny what you just said. Can I use that? I was like, I don't know. I gotta go to work tomorrow. I have no idea what you're talking about, bro. And so then one time he came home and he was like, man, I made $1,100 this week. I made $1,400 that week. I'm like, doing what? He was like, come here. I told you I'm a stand-up. He was like, if anybody can do this, you can. And he basically taught me how to do my set, signed me up for a big comedy competition. It was the biggest at the time. The Johnny Walker National Comedy Competition was one they did locally, and you keep competing until you wind up, the final, the winner would be on Johnny Carson. And that was a big deal. Like, that was a big deal. Johnny Carson, maybe Jay Leno. It was the Tonight Show, version it was.
Sure.
I think it was still Johnny at that time.
So he's saying he signed you up, but you're into the idea, or was it nerve-wracking, or what?
Of course, I'd performed in plays, and I'd been in singing groups. So I'd been on stage. It wasn't like, I just didn't think I could do stand-up. But he was a guy who, again, still works as a professional, and showed me how to do the set. And that was it. So I won $500 the first time I ever did comedy.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Now, had you consumed stand-up yourself before, whether it was live or on TV or anything? I'd read that one guy who meant something to you was Robin Harris. Was that right?
Oh, man, that was my guy. The late Robin Harris was the comedian who, for the most part, inspired me to do it, in the sense that he was a guy that didn't look like the shiny superstar. I loved Richard Pryor. Of course, Eddie Murphy was of my era and amazing and was like superstar. And then we started to meet the Wayans, but they all felt like New York and really polished and better. And Robin Harris was from Chicago and just kind of performed like your uncle, like a cousin. And I was like, once I saw like you can actually become famous being like fairly regular or in a way super personable, it became the thing I really thought, okay, I can do this.
That's interesting because that really has always been your thing, like, right? I mean, people feel like that you could be someone they know.
Yeah, that's literally my brand, man. And I try to do that in the sense that you know, I feel that way. Coming from the Midwest, coming, you know, single-parent household, kind of like you're a butterfly, you're looking for father figures, you're constantly looking for, like, kind of approval. So you often, like, just communicate with people in this, like, hey, we're family already. Like, and so I think that I kind of took that attitude and loved the fact that I was able to bring it to a stage and learn how to be even more comfortable with it, and of course that there end up being a lane where you can become popular doing it too, because it's something about feeling too regular to people that, you know, they won't, they, dude, you're like my barista.
Okay, so we'll get this one out of the way. I'm sure you get it every single time you've ever been interviewed, but how do we go from Cedric Kyles to Cedric the Entertainer with, I believe, Cheerio in the middle?
Let's stop playing with the name. Don't play with my name. Cheerio was a legend, man. So Cheerio was just one of those, you know, of course, you try to figure out what your career is. And it was a guy that he went by Kodak. That's all I remember is that he was Kodak. And I was trying to think of a one word name, you know, that had a C in it. And Cheer came up, and then Cheerio was a derivative of that. So,
you tried it.
So I was Cheerio. I had a chain and everything, man. I had the chain.
This was early days, right?
Super early days, man. But with some popularity. Like, people knew who I was locally in St. Louis. So
until, I guess, there was a cease and desist letter.
Yeah, so General Mills, he was like, no, sir, that's not going to happen. So, because I think they put my name on a billing somewhere, and eventually it came back to them like, no. Kodak had to change his name, too.
Seriously? Oh, geez. Okay, so then of course, Cedric the Entertainer. That you didn't grow up as that. It's not on your birth certificate. Where did that come along?
No, you know, that was really fairly serendipitous too. I always say, like, it's a really big name and a big moniker to have had this long and doing my career. I've definitely had people tell me I should change it along the way, but it was really an opportunity when I was performing one night. I did not have a lot of jokes. Mm-hmm. And so, but I used to, because I had worked in corporate America, I wanted to get paid the kind of money. You get paid in time in comedians, as comedians. You know, you're the opening act, you get this amount. You're the middle act, you get this amount. You're the headliner, you get this amount. Mm-hmm. The middle money only made sense to me because I was a guy that had a job.
Yeah.
So I was like, I need to make the middle money. I need to have 30 minutes worth of stuff. I didn't have 30 minutes worth of jokes, so I would sing, I would dance, I would have a poem I would do. And so I just basically told the guy, he was announcing everybody as this next comedian. I was like, don't call me a comedian, call me an entertainer. And he announced me as Cedric the Entertainer. And I went up, I had a great show. And when I got out, he called me Cedric the Entertainer again, and that was it. I just kept it.
You embraced it, yeah. Okay, so I think if there's a handful of, like, turning points in anyone's life, it seems like one of yours would have been when you and Steve Harvey first met.
Sure.
So this, I believe, is like late 80s?
Yeah, like 88 maybe, 87, 88, somewhere in there.
How did this happen?
Again, you know, one of those kind of luck of the draw things. I was booked to perform at a comedy club in Dallas. I'd driven from St. Louis 10 hours. I was supposed to make $300. And, you know, for the week, $350 or something, I had $100 on me. So I was like, you know, I'll have a little food, I'll do the shows, I'll come back with, you know, with a nice little amount of money, I'll be good, you know. When I got there, it was new ownership at the club, and they were like, we don't do out-of-town opening acts. We do local opening acts. Sorry.
Jeez.
So I was like, yo, I happened to hear Steve on the radio. The same guy that taught me to do comedy knew Steve from being there, both pros.
Who was this?
Percy Cruz.
Okay.
Percy Cruz was the comedian that kind of walked me into it. And so he told Steve about me, and I knew about Steve through him. So I heard Steve on the radio promoting his comedy night. He's got a night going in Dallas. I go by. I'm like standing outside. Hey, man, Percy told me about you. He was like, come on in. And it just so happens that the guy that was the headliner was not doing well. He was bombing. Steve asked me, could I go up and do 5 minutes to get the crowd? And I did. And he just told me to keep coming back every night. He was like, if this dude bombs, I'm putting you up. Just do. And you never want another comedian to do bad. Right. But boy, I was putting the juju on dude, man. So, but and then Steve was able to give me $200 to get home. And then he booked me immediately to come back like a couple of months later to be a headliner and pay me $1,000. And I'd never been paid $1,000 to do comedy ever. So we were locked in from there.
And you guys just on a personal level hit it off also?
Yeah, you know, that was the thing about it. You know, again, he's a great comedian and he had a lot of clubs. He had a really great entrepreneurial spirit. So, but whenever he would go work and do his bigger shows, he would ask, could I come and host his club for him and be the host? And so that ended up being a regular gig for me. Of course, that, you know, solidified our friendship as someone he could trust to step in when I'm gone. And then, you know, when he would show up, we would just go on stage and have a good time together and just became really friends over the years. So as the opportunities to do television, those kind of things came into fruition. They were just that natural, this is my guy kind of thing. Steve was like, give me said. That's if I'm picking a team at the park, you know, like my 1-2, I'm like, you know, he would like, give me said. And that was how I got a lot of my TV breaks.
That's great. Well, so just to mention some of the early exposure that people might have had to you. You appear on It's Showtime at the Apollo in 92. You host BET Comic View from 93 to 94. HBO Def Comedy Jam 95. In the middle of that, you win this Richard Pryor Comic of the Year Award. But then in around 95, it seems like there was a decision to broaden into acting a bit.
Yeah.
And I wonder, what is that something that you think most comedians want to expand into just because it's another avenue to make a living? Or what for you was the reason to do that?
Oh, it's definitely the desire. I think most comedians, we start at stand-up and we see our natural trajectory is to get a sitcom or become, you know, a movie star, which was very rare. I mean, you know, Eddie Murphy, again, was on television. We loved him on Saturday Night Live. And then he very quickly became a movie star. That kind of led to me to, I think, of the paths of people like Chris Tucker, mm-hmm. who were parallel with, you know, we were all the same, but then he became a movie star and kind of skipped television. And so you're like, oh, okay. So, but for me, TV was natural. I Steve was my most kind of guided light, and he did television. He went from stand-up to TV to, you know, making other kind of appearances, hosting otherwise. Yeah. So I kind of looked at that as like, that's the steps that I want to make. And, you know, my comedy was one where I did a lot of characters anyway. I would do reenactments of my grandfather or this thing at a church and would act the whole thing out. Right. So it became fairly natural for me to want to act next. So.
So just, I think, not even a year into you starting to audition and go out for things, Steve has put together the Steve Harvey Show. This goes on in 96, goes all the way to 2002. And I think from the beginning, his character's best friend, roommate, the gym coach, was Cedric the Entertainer, playing Cedric Jackie Robinson.
Yeah.
And I just wonder, I guess – this was on WB.
Yeah,
and syndicated on UPN, I think, right? A lot.
Yeah, afterwards. Yeah, afterwards. Because WB was the big thing at that time. And all those networks started around that same time. UPN, CW came a little bit afterwards, and then WB. It seemed like it was one other one. Fox was fairly new at that time, too, maybe a year before those guys.
And all of those that you just mentioned, I remember, I know this is kind of random, but just this came up in another conversation recently. You know, there was this period, I guess, sort of mid-90s, maybe into the early 2000s, right when you're doing the Steve Harvey Show, when sort of black sitcoms, if you can call it that, were just omnipresent.
Oh, yeah.
And then they went away.
Yeah.
And it was partly, I guess, because the networks something became the CW or whatever. Like, there was some contracting and expanding and whatever, but like, there was that moment when it was a golden age of there's actually a good book I just somebody gave me recently about this. I forget what it's called, but like, what was your understanding of why all of a sudden, you know, aside from like the Norman Lear shows, there hadn't really been too many black centric sitcoms?
No, I mean, you had very few. You know, the networks were growing, of course. You had the juggernaut, like the Cosby Show, that was a big one. And then, like, right, you said in that 90s, right there was the new networks. It was this expansion of television. You know, cable had come into real play. People started to see the opportunities of growing. Fox decided, you know, they were creating a brand. And so I always say black sitcoms are the $5 footlong of television. It's the deal that you make to get everybody to come in. And then eventually, basically what they did, it was like, then they decide they want to be a little bit more, respected or something like that. And so you start to see all of those networks turn away from those shows. But again, it was a lot of networks coming to play, and that led to the opportunity to do content with an audience that, you know, is going to show up mainly for culture or to see themselves on television, because it was such a, drastic, emptiness without it otherwise. Yeah. So now, you know, it's, you know, black people on television, you like, I'm turning to that. And that's how they gain market share. And so then after they kind of got it, then I think it was just a normal. Yeah, they bailed, you know. Ugh. You can't get a $5 foot long to save your life.
Well, so for you, those, I don't know, about 6 years on that show.
Yeah.
You've said it really made a huge impression on you and kind of taught you the roots of what you know and go by in this business. And I wonder if you can talk about, it sounds like it was seeing how Steve handled being number one on the call sheet, running the thing, like, but I don't want to put words in your mouth. What was it about that?
Well, that was the truth. I actually, I had an opportunity because I had landed a deal to do my own sitcom in that period, somewhere in that gap. And so I actually had an opportunity to create a show and be my own guy. And then Steve got this opportunity and wanted me to be on his show. And I actually saw him do Me and the Boys, his first show. Uh-huh. And I was like, I think to be in the shotgun seat and watch how television is made and see, kind of being able to not have the onus of being the number one guy there and still have, that real connective power. It was just a good space for me. And it's always been the kind of way I like to move, mm-hmm. kind of like, in the front, but in the shadows. Yeah. Like, I don't necessarily have to be the number one guy, but I do, want to get in free, so I do want to get in the club free.
Well, it was a good calculation. Yeah, it was a good run, there, because, baby. Yeah, I mean, what a run. So, okay, this brings us in the middle. I guess it definitely started right in the middle of the Steve Harvey Show run, the Kings of Comedy Tour. Yeah. So I guess to start with, who is Walter Latham, who I believe at that point was just in his mid-20s?
Young dude. Yeah, he was a young guy. He was a promoter. And Walter actually was a person that, I think that really led to, him pulling off the Kings of Comedy. He had a great deal of vision of what entertainment could be. As a young guy, he had a lot of hubris, and he, believed in himself. And so he would do each of us individually on tours, So we would do, theater shows, 2,000 seats, you know, 3,000 seats, 5,000 seats. But, you know, Steve, Bernie Mac, he would do them mm-hmm. as their promoter. He did a tour with me and D.L. Hewley as the host of Comic View, because D.L. hosted BET's Comic View before me, and then I became the host. And he had the idea of putting us out together as this and taking young BET comics with us as these other acts, support acts. So we were out, and I think, you know, at that point, that's when it came to him to do one big kind of mega fest kind of feeling show where all your favorites show up at once. And so that was an amazing time. The original Kings was, you know, it was just rock star comedy. Nobody was doing it like that. I mean, we had big stars that were going individually doing arenas, but not in a group, like not that kind of like everybody's there, like a Coachella feel, like I'm there for all my favorite acts are kind of here.
Totally. And we should just remind people. So I believe Latham kind of puts this, you know, brings the group together in 97.
Yeah.
98, 99, 2000, you guys are out there doing it. Initially, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, it was just Steve, Bernie, and yourself. Then DL joined a bit later, 99. But this idea, I mean, within, you know, you'd each had your own fan bases.
Yeah.
But there was something about having you all together. I mean, this became the highest grossing comedy tour ever.
Yeah, there was I mean, it was one of those things. Like, it became a phenomenon. I mean, to be able to go in and sell like four United Centers in Chicago, four MCI Centers in D.C. This was crazy numbers, you know, and the experience that people were having just culturally. And that was the tour. We toured so long before people even saw the movie. Yeah. And so, you know, the idea is that we like really had such a great time out touring the show and being friends and having that great camaraderie, and it was just totally different than how we all had done it as individuals. And so it was rock star comedy before Kevin Hart.
Yeah, right. Well, so the interesting thing, you know, you mentioned the movie doesn't come until August of 2000. Well, I don't know, more than 2 years since you guys started.
Yeah,
I guess Spike Lee was aware obviously of the tour, and here's something he said, quote, "It was the most successful comedy tour ever, and mainstream America didn't even really know about it," close quote. So I guess his idea was, we'll film it and put it out there, and let's see. I mean, why wouldn't it also play with everyone else?
Yeah.
So I guess two performances in February 2000, shot in Charlotte, 12 cameras. Was, you know, for you guys as the performers, was it any different doing those shows that were filmed for the movie, or was it just another, you know, another two nights of doing what you've been doing dozens of times?
Well, I mean, you know, of course you recognize your shooting, but I mean, Spike, you know, and you know, Spike was a choice for us. Like, all of us kind of, you know, we were looking at how do we shoot this movie, and, you know, and of course Spike, you know, he pitched his thought around it, and him being like that real purveyor of culture and, you know, this great filmmaker, we like, oh man, it just comes with this extra cachet. And again, you know, because he's a pro, he was able to disappear into the scene. So like on stage, it didn't feel any different. Only thing that we, you know, we had to shoot a lot of stuff in order for you to cut in and out. That's the only thing, you know, for us, we were like, all right, what's this? We got to be at the car place this morning. Right. Got to get up and go on the bus. We want to bring the cameras on the bus. We're like, whoa, man, we're free on the bus.
Right.
We
don't, right.
No, we need the cameras to capture that. You're like, right. Oh, okay, got it. Right. So that was the thing. That was the things we got aware of. But the night, the doing it, it was amazing. It was all fine.
Here's another, I don't know, you can confirm if it's true or not, but in the film, I believe, if I remember correctly, the order of the performers is Steve, DL, you, Bernie, right?
Yeah.
That was not how it was shot.
No.
What happened?
Yeah. I closed that tour. Bernie said he called it the hammock. He was like, he had been on a big tour before. He'd always been like the main dude. And he was like, man, I just don't want to go last. So that was kind of his position. Everybody like, all right, fine. When we started the tour, I used to go first. So before we added DL, I would go first. And we had a opening act. I would go first. then Bernie, he was in the hammock, and then Steve. And then Steve became the host. Right. We added DL, and then I went to the middle, and then Bernie went to this hammock spot, and I closed. And that was just the way the tour was. And so, you know, but for the movie, his comedy was way bluer and you know, edgier. And it just made sense that we would, like, close the show on something that was, like, super raw.
One more question before we talk about just how big this movie was when it came out. But so you guys were spending a lot of time together. I mean, what was it, like 50 shows a year or something?
Yeah, a lot of shows, a lot of work.
Did you guys all, I mean, I know it could be your best friend. If you spend that much time with somebody, you can get sick of them. Yeah. Did you guys all mesh well, or were there, what was it like behind the scenes?
It was a couple of legendary beefs. I mean, Steve and Bernie, they had their little riffs. Everybody else was cool. Like me, DL, we're still like boys to this day and families, me and Steve. So I was always this kind of flow. Me and Bernie, I always flowed in between. Right. They, you know, again, those they had that kind of overtly alpha male energy, both of them. So they definitely had some runs there at the end that I felt at the end of the tour where it was like, okay, you know, they didn't necessarily have to be in the same room with each other.
And that's actually supposedly partly why we maybe never saw a sequel.
Well, you know, I think it really kind of came down. The sequel really kind of came down to that Walter thought he was the real king of comedy.
Oh. So it's never.
He got to the point where he didn't need us. We was like, geez. Oh, okay, bro. Get up there and tell some jokes there.
Right.
So, but, you know, I think it got very business kind of oriented and murky, and people started to, like, have their own corners, you know, and I think that's like any kind of, like, big band, you know, you got to figure out that out. But, you know, again, unfortunately, Bernie passed, man. But, you know, toward the end, it was, we were really in talks of, like, figuring out, like, how we can go back out, do a little run, shoot another special. And then once Bernie passed, it just, for the rest of us, it just didn't seem like the right idea. Right. I always get this every day. Somebody go like, well, it should be you, Dave Chappelle. You know, I was like, those, you know, like, that's not, it's a thing that works, like, in, you know, in concert. It just has to be all right. So, right. You know, those guys are legends for sure.
And the way that so Paramount puts out the Spike movie, or you guys, Spike's movie of you guys. I don't want to make it that it's his thing. But comes out in August, this is a $13 million budget, apparently. $38 million gross. That, you know, as you say, Kevin Hart and people have followed, but this was like unprecedented.
Yeah, no, this was crazy at the time, and nobody was doing that. You know, I mean, like I said, it was a couple of people did arena tours before us, be it Dice and Eddie Murphy. I think even Martin did. But those are the ones I can think. But nobody had did this group thing, and so that made it feel so much like a, you know, super exciting idea, and it just did well. And kind of to Spike's point, we didn't have any press. We were like maybe number two on touring, like behind Janet Jackson and Rolling Stones one year, and nobody even knew about us. It was not talked about. It wasn't.
What do you think that was about?
Trade. I think that one time comedy was very. You know, it had started to be very kind of, you know, separate. It was black comedy, it was white comedy. I think that ours was very uniquely and very super specifically considered black comedy. Like, and so it just didn't feel like it was important to anybody. And I would think, you know, the same kind of thing goes, you know, in the TV shows. Oftentimes the shows kind of fall, unless they have a crossover appeal, like unless they somehow resonate to the larger society, the importance that they have to our culture doesn't seem to translate to them what it means for overall economy business. And so that's what we kind of felt was the case in that. It was like, you know, because the blue collar guys came after us and of course was able to, you know, take that same concept and become, you know, super rich off theirs, you know.
Again, you had a following before any of this, but did it change anything, the success of the film?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, the film, again, opened up the idea that a lot more people became exposed to us. And it became way more acceptable to go out and laugh and be, you know, even, you know, for the society at whole, all cultures was like now invited into this world of comedy and saying, oh, I didn't even know this existed. Like, that's funny. And so, you know, my audience became bigger and more diverse. You know, of course, doing like commercials with Bud Light and all those kind of things. But Super Kings Bowl, of Comedy, right? Yeah. Kings of Comedy definitely opened it up, and I started to see, you know, just a lot more kind of Indian, and of course, eventually international exposure. You just started to be known. Yeah. You know, people like, oh man, they telling your jokes and walking up. You're like, what? Oh, Kings of Comedy. Yeah, got right. it. Yeah, I forgot.
Well, I guess the other big thing is that film took off for you, right? Yeah. So. Can I just prompt you about a few of these? You know, we don't have to go in depth, but just a few of your most memorable ones. Eddie, the old school barber in Barbershop. This is 2002. Eventually, there's two sequels. Yeah. I mean, there are moments there where you do some dramatic stuff too, which was – but just what, you know, that one and the idea that it became this big franchise.
Again, such a unique space, man. It was one of those it was one of those roles, you know, I went in for a read. I think I knew one of the producers, you know, the producers that were doing the movie, and they were like, yeah, we just come just read it, you know, help us hear it out loud, you know, one of those kind of days. There's a bunch of actors around, and, you know, I wanted to read The Old Man, and I did it, and I had everybody laughing. So they thought that was just for the read, and they were like, all right, cool, when we cast you, we want you to be the guy that's, you know, robbing the convenience store. And I said, no, I want to play the old man.
Yeah.
And it's like, for real? Like, I was like, yeah. So it was a lot going against it. A lot of people like, we should hire a real old actor. We don't want this. But, you know, I told them, and I, you know, I had this whole idea looking like Frederick Douglass. I grew my hair. That was my real hair in the first one. Like, I did all of that on purpose. So
amazing.
Yeah.
Okay, that was 2002. 2003, we got the Coen Brothers, Intolerable Cruelty.
Oh, fun.
Yeah, I mean, just they're interesting filmmakers, I imagine.
They are. And, you know, and of course, the opportunity to work with George Clooney, right, and Catherine Zeta-Jones, and Jeffrey Rush. It was just some legends of a part of that film. And, you know, you know, the Coen brothers, they were guys that, you know, again, they have their unique sense of humor, the way they kind of see a film. And so just inside that, I was able to kind of find Elaine that I thought was a funny character to play.
Yeah.
And Gus Patch is, you know, he goes down, I'll nail your ass.
All right. So the next year is Barbershop 2, Back in Business. The year after that, F. Gary Gray, Be Cool, the sequel to Get Shorty, You, Travolta.
The Rock, the Young Rock.
Yeah.
Nobody knew The Rock was done. Vince Vaughn. Oh, Harvey Keitel, Uma Thurman. That movie was lit, man.
Totally.
That was crazy. So, you know, that was another really cool opportunity. F. Gary Gray was one of my favorite directors. I'd loved, he did Friday, which was a hood classic everybody loved. And then The Negotiator was one of my favorites with Sam. And, you know, you didn't know him to do action movies. But once he kind of done that one, I was like, okay. And then, of course, we all loved, you know, the original Get Shorty. And so Be Cool to be able to do a, you know, Elmore Leonard kind of, you know, piece. And to be in the film with all these great actors. And I just love that F. Gary Gray wanted to kind of cast me out of type. Like, you know, like, okay, not straight comedy. You're this kind of Harvard business gangster. You're a Wharton graduated gangster, right, street gangster. I was like, yes, I know this person. So it was just fun to play that character, one of my favorite roles right there.
So what you're talking about not, you know, I don't either people seeing you or you – maybe in some cases pursuing not just quote unquote, but you know, a comedic lane. There are others here that people may need a reminder, but like Talk to Me, for instance, Cassie Lemons, you're playing this DJ. This, I think, the beginning of you and Don Cheadle, I know, are tight. That was, but this is an interesting kind of dramatic part. Same thing a year later, Cadillac Records. Music biz in the 40s through the 60s. But like, these are dramatic parts. Did you always aspire to get beyond the comedy box, or was that just things that came along? Like, what was that important to you to get to do those?
Definitely important to me. I think, you know, I've always loved the idea of being very versatile, you know, being able to do stand up, to be able to, you know, do it from television to film, to be able to, you know, do Broadway, to do up, you know, commercials, like any way I can entertain the crowd, man. You know, I loved it. So, you know, of course, you know, some of my favorite comedians became really strong dramatic actors. The late Robin Williams, mm-hmm. you know, one of my favorites. Even Richard Pryor did really great roles and surprisingly roles. And I just love that when you see a comedian like take something and make it really real. And I was like, I definitely have, you know, a strong desire to do that and would look for it and would tell my professionals, agents and managers that, you know, find me something, man. I want to do something different.
Well, and you referenced Broadway. That was the same year as Cadillac Records, American Buffalo on Broadway, which is, you know, it can be funny, but it's pretty dark.
Yeah.
That was a big one. I know more recently First Reform for Paul Schrader. Yeah. So it's just interesting that, you know, obviously you've been so great in comedy that it maybe sometimes overshadows these others, but I think there's something for people to think about.
Yeah,
but,
man. Yeah.
So this brings us to one last thing before we talk about your most recent activities, and that's sort of this last, let's say, decade or so on TV, regular series TV, first with TV Land, where it starts off with this guest spot on Hot in Cleveland, which becomes its own thing, The Soul Man, for 54 episodes over like 4 or 5 years. And pretty much not long after that, into The Neighborhood on CBS, which I guess I just wonder, that's a different lifestyle than other kinds of work, you know, doing series TV. I know it's demanding, but yeah, you seem to like it.
Yeah, you know, it became a choice, of course, you know, L.A., you know, we had the movie business started to move out of L.A., and so all the movies that I would get would, you know, take me away. Vancouver, you're in Toronto, you're in Shreveport, you know, like, and so my kids were starting to get to an age where their schedules, first they could come with me and it was easy, and they can be home and they can come and stay for, you know, a month or so, but it started to get really, you know, awkward where, you know, so I was like, television just became a choice for me to have a little bit more kind of normalcy with my wife and my kids and to have a life that felt like a regular life. So I made the choice to do television during that period. And so, you know, got really lucky. I loved The Soul Man. It was fun. TV Land was, you know, again, one of the smaller networks in that Viacom family, but they were in the Viacom family. So that made, you know, that's what made me comfortable. The deal felt the same as any place else. But it allowed me the kind of freedom to do a show that I wanted to do. And it was fun, and, you know, we had a good time. Of course, get to work with the amazing Niecy Nash, who's done so many cool things since then, and that cast was amazing. And then the Neighborhood came along right after, and I was developing other shows for CBS. We had, you know, got a bigger deal to produce and create, because I co-created and produced The Soul Man. And so the Neighborhood, you know, opportunity came, and it was another, you know, just end up being another kind of great choice, great win. I love it. It's the best job in Hollywood. I always tell people that. I mean, it seems like it's a lot, but doing multicam sitcoms, you don't, man, my office hours, it's like, dude, I might as well be a, I don't even know who works less than me.
Oh, interesting. Like, okay, because I figured so it's not all consuming.
No, man, it's so big. It's great. One, you have a great cast, but it is, we, you know, we have shoot days, Mondays and Tuesdays. Mondays you shoot without an audience. Tuesdays, in the old days, you have an audience
yeah,
there.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's fun. You're putting on a play in front of people.
Yeah.
But, You know, but Wednesdays is a quick rehearsal. Thursdays is another short rehearsal. Fridays was my early day because as a stand-up, I used to like to go and work on Fridays right. and Saturdays. And so the network was like, cool, as long as we feel good about the show, peace out.
Not
so,
bad. And here we are, five seasons,
yeah,
just finished your fifth.
Six. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that these days on network TV, that doesn't really happen that often.
Super rare, man. And it's one of those things that, you know, I think we're all still having a great time, you know, and I look forward to that run, whatever it can be. You know, you have, you know, shows that ran forever. I try always convince the, you know, the execs at CBS, like, I want the African-American sitcom record,
yeah,
which would be the Jeffersons at 11 seasons.
Okay, so you're going to keep going.
So it's like, let's go. Like, you know, so I don't know if they're going to do it.
That sounds cool, but you'd be up for
it. I love it. I like to be in the books as, you know.
That's
like,
cool.
Yeah.
Well, and we'll just as a last side note here, you as yourself, I mean, people obviously respond to you when you're doing stand-up, where there's an element of yourself, but you, I mean, think about just the variety I'm saying to the listeners, not you. You've, yeah. I'm sure you've thought, like, 2005 White House Correspondents Association dinner, yeah. Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, 2021 Emmys. There aren't too many people that could do those three different things and have people, you know, connect with, you know, have it yeah. work with people. I guess it maybe comes back to what we were talking about at the beginning, just sort of a relatability as opposed to, you know, what, unattainability. Or some people feel like they're, you know, Julia Roberts doesn't seem like a real person to people
right.
or somebody, you know. But there's something that allows you to succeed in all these different kinds of areas.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's something I embrace. I embrace that idea of being able to understand. And I think that, you know, it comes up a little bit from my background. I was kind of, you know, I was raised in a small rural town, Caruthersville, Missouri, before we moved to St. Louis. So then, and then moved right into the inner city. So you have that combination of being a small town guy that knows how to operate in the big city. You know, I went to college. I worked in corporate America. You know, I hung with street dudes. I had this whole thing, you know, where I feel like I could just have conversations with so many people. And I like to take that on stage. I like to kind of know that that audience is not filled with just one person, right. You know, like as well as people traveled, as people from different cultures in this room. Some people do this, some people do that. And I could write a joke for like that space and hopefully let it be shared amongst the group.
Right.
So it's not like me kind of talking to one particular group of people at any given time.
Right.
And I like that. I had to learn that I was telling somebody I bombed on stage. Steve, you know, came and get me because I tried to switch my show one time to talk to executives only. Like it was a room full of executives and I tried to switch up and thought I was speaking, you know, to this room of very smart people and I bombed. And then Steve went up and cussed them out like in some regular and they were dying.
Yeah.
And he was like, man, just be yourself. Don't, yeah. you know, if people get it, then don't worry about it.
That's
and I was like, that was a great lesson, you know, and I always tell young comedians that too to this day. Just lock in, man. Don't worry about it.
So just when it didn't seem possible that there was anything else that you could do that you had not already done, here we are. It's 2023, and Amistad, an imprint of HarperCollins, is about to put out Flipping Boxcars, a novel co-written by Alan Eisenstock with yourself,
yeah,
your
man.
Prince, or you with Alan
yeah,
Eisenstock.
Yeah.
How did we get to this?
Oh, man, you know, this was really something that was inside of me, man. I had this book idea or this story idea about my grandfather. And this comes, I guess, as a guy growing up, again, single-parent household. My dad wasn't really there. My mom raised me. But a lot of the things that I kind of feel define me as a male, you know, and the way I kind of operate as a man came through some osmosis DNA, some mm-hmm. weird factor. And my mother would often say, you know, my daddy would have did something like that. Now, he had passed before I was, you know, born. So
when you say things that reminded her, like, I mean, I'm just imagining here, but you have always dressed
yeah.
really nicely. Is that one of the, or, yeah. you know, like in a way that's almost of a different era. Yeah, is that exactly. one of the things that she's talking about? Or
I think so, yeah, because I was like in high school, junior high school, wanting to wear mohair sweaters, and I needed a certain, I needed my shirts pressed.
Interesting.
She would be like, what? You know, what kid needs his shirt pressed? And I'm like, I need a tie to go with this, mom.
Yeah.
And, you know, and would, you know, but would learn to go to the Goodwill or the trade, you know, thrifty stores and figure out how to put my outfits together without it being a burden to her. You know, witty, you know, would say witty things. Entrepreneur, always trying to think of a, you know, she would say, oh, that's scheming up a dream. Always scheming up a dream. That was my, you know, my grandfather always had like a play going, always had a move he needed to make. That was the next move. And so I, you know, I kind of thought like, man, to be basically to been me in the 40s where not necessarily it was a like a easy path to find yourself. You had all the you know, the racism of America, you had all of the challenges of being in a small rural town, all these things, and to think like, man, these were the, this was the identity that I took on a generation later to actually have the opportunity to do it in a big way. And so that really was the inspiration to be able to kind of say, man, our lives are connected to the people that we are born from, that we have that we share DNA with, and somehow we are a part of that train. Years later, it's the same, you know, train moving.
Yeah.
And so I was inspired to write a tale because I never met him. So I would have these machinations of him just pop in my head, like, you know, he's on his way, you know, to Memphis to go do something, and I would have a whole scene of like what would happen. And so I would write him down and jot him down, and when Amistad approached me about doing a book, I was like, this is the thing I want to do. I don't want to do another, you know, comedian. This is my life, right, and how right. I became to be. And so they were like, you know, we like it. We gave him a little tidbit of what it was. And I kind of worked on this in another way because I, you know, after started producing television, that was my first choice. So I wanted to write a TV show, and I had the outlines of that.
Oh, this same story could have been a TV.
Yeah.
Because I was wondering, it sounds cinematic. It could be like maybe now that once the book gets out, maybe would you want to bring it to the screen? Yeah.
Oh, for sure. Definitely. Yeah, we have a version that was a TV show. And then, you know, when the opportunity to write a book, it felt like a smarter place to start to me. I was like, oh, let's just do the book and let it tell a nice, great fictional tale. And, you know, I had such a great time with it. I teed it up. Even in the book, if you read it, it's got like three cliffhangers in there where you're like, I want to know what else happened.
Totally.
So that I believe it could be a great series if we really catch a wave with it.
Well, so the process of writing a book.
Yeah.
Takes a lot of discipline. I am trying to do something maybe that will one day, I know it's tough. Did you enjoy it? Did you – what was your – you know, some people need to get up every day at like 5 a.m. and write for 2 hours or whatever version of that. Are you disciplined like that? Was it fun? Just what was the process like?
Yeah, the process, you know, Alan was a really great, great collaborator because I had a lot of pages and I had the idea and I had so many ideas. Like, and sometimes it's just random. They would just be a random thought. I'd be like, yo, you know, my grandfather would just, in my mind, he would go, hey, the suit don't make the man, but it makes the difference. You'd be like, huh? You're like, what would you, like, all right, cool, bet. I like that one, you know, so. And so these were little things that I would just kind of jot down. And what Alan and I did, we literally just would talk, get on the phone once a week, sometimes twice a week, kind of talk about what we think is, a, you know, the story and laugh, and, you know, and start coming up with things, adding stuff to the pot. And then, you know, he would write pages, I would write pages, and we would try to collect, mess them up. And then he finally, you know, helped me, like, say, all right, cool, what if we do it around 4 days, it's an event, it's driven, it's got a clock, and we can tell the story, and then we can figure out how to get all of this information in there. And that became the real cool puzzle, too. So, you know, we just started to do the book like that. Took, you know, of course, well over a year because you're just going back and forth, and you're like, I don't know about this one. I wouldn't say that.
Well, when you started on this, did you know how it was going to end, or do you sort of paint yourself into a corner?
No, that's this is the stuff, right? This is really what Arthur goes through, because you don't, you think you do.
Yeah.
You like, oh, and then you start to get into it, and you're like, man, the what I thought would be the ending, I had to tell that story early on to be able to make it make sense for you to care.
Right.
So now I don't have an ending, because what I thought was the ending was I needed to get that in the book so that you can be like, all right, now I care about the character.
Yeah, yeah. And it's sort of, in terms of like painting your characters into corners or whatever. I mean, in this case, right, there's an element of a guy who's gambled a lot.
Yeah.
Used to winning, but then can get himself into a corner.
Yeah.
Get himself into trouble.
Yeah. And like most of us, we count on our hubris and our ability to, you know, do magic somehow throughout our lives. You'll be like, I can't pay my bills, and you're like, I don't know what's gonna happen, and then somehow life works. You're like, okay, and then you start to lean on it, and then you know, and sometimes you can put yourself in a real hole. And that's what I love about, you know, this particular character in this story. And we did. We dug some holes, and then we were like trying to figure out, you know, but, you know, the challenge is to do it and still be true to the character, still be true to the storytelling, and decide like, okay, even though I kind of put myself in this wall, what could happen to a guy like this? What would be his move? And so, you know, and you just get inspired. We just go again. And so
that's great.
It was just really fun, man.
So just last few things to wrap it up. Would you, having been through this experience, would you like to write another book?
I already started.
Really?
I'm super excited. Like I said, I dug some holes, and then just recently, of course, after going through this whole process, and but I had to do the audiobook. And once I did the audiobook, I became more inspired. Like, but when I finally like read the last few pages of the audiobook, I just started to clearly see more stories, more. And so I started to jot down how I would start this story and what would happen and what
different
would happen.
Different characters?
Same characters.
Same characters.
Babe is there. Of course, we expand his world a little bit.
Yeah.
But Babe is my, you know, he is my, you know, my muse character that drives it.
That's great. Up-and-coming comedians, who are you most impressed by these days?
Oh, man, there's so many funny young comics out there. Of course, we had an opportunity to tour this last summer with DC Young Fly. And, you know, he's just a hard-working guy, creative, bold. I like... and it's hard to call these guys young comedians right now, but Roy Wood Jr. is one of my favorites, man. Like I just
followed in your footsteps to the White House Correspondents
Association. Yeah, so amazing. I did hit him immediately after that. Just thought he was really killing the game. You know, I love a lot of these, you know, a lot of comedians out here. There's so many talented people, and I'm a big fan of comedy. So I just saw Rami Youssef last night for the first time. I'd never seen him. My wife was watching the special, and I was like, I've seen his show,
yeah, sure,
but never his stand up. And it was like, oh, this dude's clever and bold and edgy and different.
Interesting.
So I love that kind of stuff.
Your dream role? I think I've heard one over the years that you've said, but I don't know if it's still the one.
Yeah, I don't know. It's kind of changed now because, you know, I used to always want to be play Marcus Garvey.
Yes, that's
I always wanted to do it. But now I know this great actor. He's about to do Marcus Garvey, and he's amazing.
Who's that?
Is it Yahya? I believe it's Yahya.
Oh, yeah, Yahya Abdul-Mateen.
Yeah. I think it's Yahya's doing it. And, you know, it's one of those people, if you know, once they get a hold to it, you're like, All right. I'm going to tap out. Like, you know, but I just love the idea of the character and the role. So it's a couple of, you know, it's a serious movie idea we've been developing about a judge in Mississippi that I want to play. And I think this is great. This kind of a person that I think is a lot like me. And but then I love the Bingo Longs and Traveling All-Stars. I don't know how you make a 19... a Negro League baseball movie nowadays where it can make sense to the youth. It's so far
removed.
There's
a good doc actually now. Have you heard about The League? It's Sam Pollard, I think, is this filmmaker.
Really?
and Magnolia's put out. It's really good about the Negro League. It made me think about
it. Okay, that'd be great. That'd be good. But I love that kind of slice of culture stuff that's more fun, more, you know, less to do with, you know, the kind of oppression of the 70s, but more like people figured it out and how to live it and be and had lives. And I love that part of our culture where we, you know, we see how we see ourselves and not necessarily, you know, the atrocities that we've had lived through.
Last question, you know, I don't know how often you're a busy guy, so I don't know how often you get a chance to kind of reflect on how, you know, like we've done over the last hour, just on how far you've come from where it began, what you've done. Just now that we're talking about it and thinking about it, just what do you make of it? It's a pretty amazing story for a guy who, you know, would have been content, it sounds like, to go to the fame kind of school. I mean, it's worked out. And what did you say? Your mom said you were a some kind of dreamer?
Scheming of a dream.
Well, it worked.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's so true, man. I think, you know, I definitely feel very blessed to have had the career that I've had. I always pride myself on being able to do a number of things. Of course, you know, I've had an opportunity to direct. You know, I'm toying with some music, you know, like all these things. It's like, hey, give it a shot. Just try it, man. So, and of course, you know, just always want to kind of, you know, continue to push and be creative. I love the fact that, you know, you recognize, and it was, we were talking about this the other day, how when we were young, somehow 50 seemed really old. And we like, when someone's 50, you're like, oh my God. But now you recognize like the opportunity to get up every day and still have great opportunity in front of you. You just don't feel like you're winding down. You feel like you're turning up. And so that's how I feel with everything that I've done in the past. I still feel like, yo, I got so many things I could do and go forward and live to and try for. And, you know, youth is definitely a thing that, you know, people take great pride in having because you feel like I get to live forever. And sometimes you get a little older and start to think like it's over and maybe I should be winding down. But, you know, I'm turning it up. So that's how I feel right now. I'm having a great time on that.
Thank you so much for doing this. Appreciate
thank
it.
You, brother. This is awesome.
Absolutely.
Thanks for listening to Awards Chatter. We really appreciate it and would really appreciate you taking just a minute more to subscribe to the podcast and to leave us a rating and review on your podcast app. And to follow us on Twitter and Instagram, where our handle is @AwardsChatter. On those platforms, we announce upcoming guests and provide details about special live recordings of the podcast that you can attend. Until next time, thanks again for tuning in.